Stanislav Kropivnik is here with us. Welcome back, Stas.
Thank you. I'm on vacation, so the lighting is, I'm not in my office, and there may be some background sounds, cars or stuff like that. Sorry.
I think since you are traveling, you may have some sort of understanding about the shortages of the petroleum in Russia, which it was. I've seen the footage of you explaining that and saying that these are lines, they're queues, right? Line after line, people are, waiting to, to fill the tanks. What is happening with the shortages in Russia?
Well, that was sarcasm. Okay. So we drove down. I was driving around Moscow to begin with, but we drove down. I'm not going to say where I'm staying. OPSEC is OPSEC, but I'm in the south. I'm in the far south. And we drove down to just across Krasnodar. It was about 1,200 kilometers. So along the roads, the interstates, I'd say probably every second. Probably about every second petrol station had fuel. There were lines here and there. There were. First of all, it's a season where a lot of people drive south. This big Russian migration begins southward because people come going to the warm weather, or warmer weather. It is warm. I mean, it's 31, 32 down here. But not the 45 of Europe or non-Russian Europe. For most of Europe, by the way, it's a pretty cold winter. Summer this year. Something that feels like winter. As long as you plan an extra 2-3 hours on the road because of, there will be lines. And then again, I kept the car tank full. So every time I went down by about a third of tank, I found a place and filled up just in case down the road it might be worse. I could have gone further, much further, and filled up less times because, there was plenty of fuel. I stood in line here and there. The worst lines were the ones when the fuel trucks arrived and they started filling up the tanks because, it shuts down. I'm not sure why it takes an hour and a half to fill up the tanks. It's something technical on their side. But, they're usually closed for about an hour and a half as they're draining the mobile tank on the truck into the underground tanks. But that's about the majority of it. Most of the lines where there were lines, there were maybe 5-6 cars deep at most per tank or per filling post. To say that this is some kind of earth-shattering, life-crushing, no. Now, depending on the company, some of them are gouging. I mean, flat-out gouging. Price has gone up no matter what. But you've got big ones like Rosneft or Lukoil. They went up for 92 octane. That's a lot higher than American's base, by the way, is 87. So for 92, which is the base in Russia, it's 92, 95, 100 now. I don't know why you'd need 100 unless you're going on race car track. But the 92 used to be about 57 rubles per liter. I figure 3.8 liters for a gallon for the Americans. Those are now about 63, 64, which is a pretty big spike as it is. It's almost, it's about 10%, 10-12%. But then there's companies like the Boyle who've jacked up to about 100, 95, 100, which I think the government needs to take a look at them. They're a major, they're also a major company. But that's gouging. Now, I wound up filling up in a couple of those places just because that's what was at hand. But that's gouging. I mean, the price is going up, but the two of the biggest are standing at 10, 12% increase. And these guys are going up fully, about 40%. And some of the mom and pops, most of the mom and pops did not have fuel, to be honest. I don't trust them anyways because they buy their fuel from the big guys. But they usually are the last ones to get delivered. So they get whatever's at the bottom of the tank, right? So they're already getting the sediment. And second of all, a lot of them aren't getting anything right now because there's still a lot more demand, particularly in the driving season. So the big boys deliver to their chains, and by the time they get to their mom and pops, there's just nothing left. But there is fuel. I mean, it's not a fuel collapse. I know there'll be many people in the West now going to open up their veins in sorrow and depression. Ah, they're not collapsing. Nope, we're not collapsing. And by the way, if you look at my videos, the crops are not rotting in the field either. No, we'll have plenty to export and plenty more to eat. In fact, the heavy equipment's all over the place working. And they're saying, one of the signs Russia's collapsing is they're not exporting diesel. Well, duh. Russia never exported. Russia has a block on diesel exports every April to about September. For the most part, because that's the agriculture sector. And depending on what part of Russia you're in, when the agriculture sector kicks in, in the very far south, they'll start plowing the fields around late March, early April. And that's because they usually get at least two harvests out of each season. And in the north, the far north, they'll plow the fields around in May, mid-May. They'll get one good harvest side because it's continuous light, very long days, so they'll get a lot of light. And if you look at the videos, what you're going to see is the first harvest is being taken in. A lot of the wheat has already been taken. It hasn't been necessarily replanted. You go further south, they're replanting already. They're done replanting for the next harvest. That's going to come in sometime late September, beginning early October. So yeah, so there, yeah. We're not going to starve. Sorry. Starvation's off the menu. In fact, starvation's off the menu for everybody who buys from Russia. So I can't guarantee for the EU, but for Africa, Asia, Egypt, for example, no starvation on their menu.
We, since you just clarified the shortages that are happening in Russia and people are so desperate in Russia because of that, I think many of the problems in Europe has been resolved with that shortage narrative that they're making to make their case with the case of Ukraine. And let me shift a little bit, Stas, with what's going on in West Asia, the Iranian attack on Jordan, which was somehow significant because the first time you see CENTCOM coming out and mentioning it, two of the soldiers were killed. Yesterday it was announced and one of them is missing. Some, 15 or 16 forces were sent to Germany because of their condition. And today they have announced two more forces were killed. And this is the situation right now with the war. And there were the war is somehow escalating because the United States has attacked or struck the Darhuin nuclear power plant in the western part of Iran. And then we had Iranian attack on power grid in Kuwait. And desalination, two of the desalination plants were hit and the power grid. Where do you see the war going? It seems that in the coming days, there would be a huge escalation between Iran and the United States. We have today is the World Cup, the final of the World Cup, and maybe tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and the coming weeks, we're going to have some sort of escalation. What is your understanding of that?
Well, I see a depopulated southern portion of the Middle East. That of the Persian Gulf. Look, those desalination plants, I'm not sure what the population of Kuwait is. Let me check right quick, just out of curiosity here.
I think it's going to be a few hundred thousand.
5.1 million.
Yeah. Oh,
of which 5.1 million, of which 1.5 million are citizens. So the rest are, paid labor. By the way, they refer to paid labor as slaves. A lot of these Arab states do. I knew a French colonel who served He hated him. He after he was a lieutenant in the Sapper after the Gulf War, and his battalion stayed to continue demining. Said when they were done, the final goodbye ceremony, the Minister of Defense of Kuwait comes out and says, "Thank you for being such good slaves for us. You were the best slaves we ever had." He said he hated those guys ever since after that. They really do. They're all pompous asses. I mean, let's be honest about it. So 1.5 million citizens, the other people are probably, I mean, realistically, it's probably a lot less right now than 5.1 million because anyone with half a brain and enough money to get the hell out has gotten the hell out. Let's just say even 4 million are left. Okay. Those desalination plants covered 50% of that population, but for 2.5 million people. So you're now down to water for 2 million, 2.5 million people with about 4 million people to feed. 50 plus degree heat. You know what type of heat there is. For the Americans, that's 120 plus Fahrenheit. If you're close to the coast, it's 100% humidity. You're further in. Let me put this one. Some friends of ours, they're Arab, they're Orthodox Arabs, Orthodox Christian. They lived in Kuwait, did some work. They had a housekeeper, and she would put out the laundry, wet clothing. She'd put it on the line, and by the time she was done putting it on the line, she goes back to the front line and starts picking it back up. Because in 5 minutes, there is no moisture left in those wet towels and bed sheets and shirts. They're dry. Absolutely dry. The air is that dry, it just sucks everything out. And they weren't that far. I mean, Kuwait's not that big. They weren't that far away from the coast, but that's the heat index. So those people now are stuck without water. So what do? They either stay and die, start fighting over the water, or they leave. I mean, there's enough water for people to survive, kind of miserably, but to survive. But how long will that last? And I think that's going to happen. The Americans have let the genie out of the bottle yet again. They've started targeting Iranian key infrastructure, power plants, bridges. It was funny because one of the bridges they took out, because Iran is in a drought, they just drive around the bridge because the river's dry. And it was one of those Trump was, "Whoa, we took out the bridge. This was a key bridge." And they're all just driving around that bridge because the river right now is dry. Sometimes drought does help. So, yeah, that's like, well, one of those, sorry. Not a big goal like you thought. But look, that the fact that these guys were killed in Jordan, if you look at the videos, first of all, it still amazes me they don't have bunkers. At this point, you go, holy shit, Batman. They still don't have bunkers. I mean, how ignorant do you have to be, and how insane do you have to be? How lazy of a commander do you have to be that your troops are still living in containers that are standing in rows, and they don't have adequate bunkers? After in the Yim, are you there?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, after and doing, even if you didn't have bunkers before that, these 2 months of pseudo ceasefire blockade, you know, that you should have been digging bunkers left and right. I mean, it's incredible washes. And the strikes, the Iranian strikes on that housing units. And the way they went up, there was an inferno. The pictures were coming out. They were just an inferno. So when you tell me two guys died and maybe two more were injured critically and died en route to Germany, and another dozen were injured, I don't believe you for a second. And from the sources I've had, you know, I was predicting not 15 guys got killed in phase one, but maybe 150, you know, off by maybe 10, a factor of 10. But I was told as well, it's well over 1,000 that were killed. So, you know, this is how many people died, a whole lot more than the U.S. government's ever going to admit to. It's like Zelensky saying, you know, there's 50,000 have died in Ukraine. And you see one cemetery, military cemetery, that's got about 50,000 graves in it from the year just in Kharkiv alone. So, you know, they're like, yeah, okay, 50,000 in 4 years have died, sure. And 10 million Russians. Don't forget that part. It's the same thing. Yeah, we've killed every Iranian that was ever born, ever lived, and we've lost two guys. That's the type of crap that's coming out of the White House right now. The same thing as you have Trump that went out and said, you know, we've we've talked to the Chinese, and the Chinese, we forced them to agree that they're not going to aid anything to Iran. And the Chinese come out, you know, an hour later, oh, no, we've never even talked. It's like, oh, yeah, well, maybe we didn't talk, but they know we're pressuring them, and they're not going to do it. Like, you know, this is a regime that lies as it breathes. Anything they say, pretty much they just ignore it. It's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, the foreign ministry of Jordan just announced that Iranian ambassador was summoned, and a strongly worded protest message was delivered to him. Jordan's security is a red line. The guy is just.
If you want a security as a red line, you get the Americans out of there, so they're not shooting things off your territory. There you go.
It's amazing to understand the mindset of these people, because on one side you see it's been how many months? 4 months, 5 months they're attacking Iran using Jordan. And right now the guy is coming out, the security is important. The security wasn't important before participating with the United States to attack on Iran. And it's unbelievable what's going on with these guys.
Also the Gulf State Arabs. Oh, we're victims. We don't know what's going on. Okay, the Americans are flying out of our territory. Oh, and they're shooting, HIMARS, high precision missiles out of our territory. But we're victims. Oh, whoops. Oh, you found out we've been shooting also? We're still victims. You know, this is like the boyfriend that comes over there, beats his girlfriend all the time. He gives her flowers, beats her some more, and says, it's really her fault. I'm the victim here. This is that level of insanity. But okay, you know, the thing is, the Hashemite kings are also not particularly popular at the moment with a lot of Jordanians, especially Palestinian Jordanians. So lots of hits, and Jordan's infrastructure going down could cost them the throne. There's a car parking right below me. The smart thing would be to tell the Americans to go. Bounce, we're closing, and we're not going to be Israel's puppet. But who's talking about smart things? None of them seem to be smart.
How do you see the targets in the southern part? You mentioned the city that they tried to hit all of the bridges around the city, Bandar Abbas, which wasn't successful, by the way. They hit the targets, they hit the bridges, and they couldn't isolate the city. It's impossible to do that. But it doesn't seem that they have any, you know, they said we have the list of the targets in Iran before these attacks come in. We're ready to go. We're ready to escalate. But looking at the targets so far, they're not that strategic. And they didn't have, because if you go strategic hitting the targets, you have to hit the missiles and drones, and then you see the secondary explosions happening. It means that you're hitting something important inside Iran. But we haven't seen that, as we've seen with Iranian attacks on Iraqi, for example, in the Kurdistan.
Look, there's two levels of targets, strategic targets. Obviously, there's key military facilities, command and control, fuel depots, things like that. Then there's hitting anti-aircraft systems, not actually strategic, it's more tactical, because you want to create an air control, air dominance bubble in some area. The other thing that would be critical to hit is, of course, when you're heading into dual purpose, dual use things like maybe military/civilian bridges for key supply routes for the military. Or energy infrastructure. That's a dual use because, you don't know that underground base may be getting powered by a local power station or through cables. Or maybe they have their own power station underground. I don't know. You may know. I don't know. I'm probably guessing they have backup power aplenty, but, why flex it when you can use local power? So more likely, but the problem for the Americans is if they really go after all the energy infrastructure, which includes water desalination plants. And for Iran, it's uncomfortable, but it's not deadly. Somewhere between 5 to 10%, it may be because of the drought, it may be a bit more, of the population lives off of desalination plants. It's unfortunate. It'll have an effect on certain sectors of agriculture, but 10% of the population can be provided with water by the rest. And if they have to cut back a little bit for the rest, that's not life-threatening. When you get to countries like Kuwait, where massively overpopulated for their geo resource, or in this case, hydro resource, you get countries like Bahrain. Bahrain is basically an artificial entity. It's a sheikdom that overgrew its size. Qatar is the same thing. You can say the same thing about Saudi Arabia. It's a desert. It's mostly desert. True, they've got fields in the south. They do grow grain. They feed a good chunk of their population off that. But the majority of the kingdom, particularly the Riyadh, is a desert city. Then you get United Arab Emirates, which were tiny little villages with a strong man sitting in there, a local sheikh, and now have become multi-million populated cities, all built on getting water through artificial means. You know, no electricity, no water. If the U.S. goes down that route, Kuwait is going to be everybody in that Gulf area. And that means those very heavily overpopulated cities are going to have to go shrink back down to whatever they can actually control for water. You can last up to a month without food. If you're really fat, you could last longer probably. But you can't last more than 2-3 days without water. And 50 degree heat, you're not going to last a day without water. I mean, that's heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and so on. So, you know, is Trump willing to sacrifice the Middle East or his allies in the Middle East? Because even those who aren't being directly affected, like, for example, Egypt, they're all going to be looking and going, how long do I want to stick with the Americans? They've shown themselves to be incapable of anything they say. Even they can't even defend Israel as much as Israel owns the U.S. Congress. Though that seems to be in question, too, now that Lindsey Graham's got him. Amazing what one person can change, or lack of one person. So at this point, I don't know. Is Trump stupid enough to go all out? Yeah, I think he is. Will anybody put a constraint on him? I don't know. I'm pretty sure the military is probably already saying, sir, maybe we shouldn't do this. Whether Trump would listen or not, that's a big question. I doubt too many generals are going to resign over this, though. After all, $1 million post-war contracts, a $1 million post-war contract, that's a lot of money. So I don't know. If the U.S. did the smart thing, they wouldn't go down the road. I mean, if the U.S. did the smart thing, they wouldn't be in this conflict to begin with. Round three of this conflict. But Trump seems dead set on it. They've even started hitting around Bashir nuclear power plant. Even though if that plant ever goes to nuclear meltdown, by the winds that are blowing right now, all of that's heading into, it'll clip Iraq, but most of it's heading into Saudi Arabia, Syria, and up into Turkey, and maybe even up into southern, southeastern Europe. We'll see. I mean, that would be another disaster Trump leaves behind. Look, Trump legacy is already going to be millions of people, if not tens of millions of people, and hopefully not hundreds of millions of people, starving to death this year and next year. That's Trump's legacy. Welcome to reality. So, and that's just a small piece of his legacy.
Do you think that they would want to, do they want Israel to be part of the war or to become part of the war actively at this stage?
I don't know. I don't think the Israelis want to be officially part of this war. I think the Americans would prefer to keep Israel a bit away to create this, again, illusion that there's a separation between the U.S. and Israel. It was always kept some kind of separation, a little bit of air of deniability, but all of that went away with the start of this conflict. It became basically America is Israel's vassal. That's what the view of most of the world is. So Trump may not want Israel in on this, one, because Israel's unpredictable, and two, because you want to have at least a little bit of air of deniability back, which is gone right now. So I don't know. I don't know if these I don't think the Israelis want to be on this. They've got their hands full trying to genocide everybody around them and steal southern Lebanon, which is going great on paper. And according to Netanyahu, it's going great. But we see on the ground, it's going anything but great. In fact, Netanyahu did a little speech to his commanders about how everything's going great. But the looks on their faces sure as hell didn't say that. They look like they've been beaten hard. So, you know, at this point, well, the problem is, now again, though, with Israel, the problem is, as bad as Netanyahu is, he's bad. The opposition is even worse. The opposition is even more psychotic than he is. It doesn't leave much hope for the future.
The reason I ask that, because we know that recently, in the recent days, 2 or 3 days, you see some sort of reduction in the interceptors that they're using. You see the difference. You see they're not in the interceptors are not hitting the missiles, or they don't use that much the air defense systems. They're basically, in my opinion, the United States is using these countries to intercept the country, the territory of these countries to intercept Iranian missiles. And maybe, somehow that's not going to happen to Israel. I don't see the United States going that far to do this to Israel. They may do this to, GCC countries, but they don't want that to happen to Israel because of the fragility of the air defense systems right now.
Well, it's even worse if what Professor Postol said is true. From what he's been studying, it looks like the rate of interception on ballistic missiles by PAC-3 interceptors are $5 million, $4.5 million a pop, is running somewhere around 4 to 5, maybe 6%. That's pretty damn bad. And we're not talking hypersonics. We're not even talking the most advanced ballistics that Iran has. It hasn't been fired. It's still going through its older stockpiles. Yeah, granted, they're not 20-year-old missiles. They're not 15-year-old. They are maybe a 10, 8-year-old missiles. But they've got more modern stuff that they haven't fired yet. Why scrap them when you can just shoot them at who's ever on the other side that you're aiming at? So at this point, I mean, we've all seen the videos where 4, 5, 6 interceptors go up and the ballistic missile just flies right through them. So at this point, you start to understand that, there's problems. There's very big problems. And building more PAC-3s that barely work, it's great for Raytheon. Oh, yeah, they're making money hand over fist. I'm sure they're taking apart lots of old television sets and lots of old monitors to get the magnets out, at least to have some magnets for the radar systems. But the point is it's unsustainable. It's unsustainable from cost benefit. And the fact is, they're not working to stop anything right now. Iran is beating, it beat Jordan like a red-headed stepchild. It just smacked them around. And the Jordanians need to get very, very antsy about this point. So is Kuwait. What are the rest of them going to do? I don't know. I mean, the smart thing would have been, by the way, Iran has blown up the bridge between Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Saudi Arabia has been sending in their military to keep the Bahrainian kings, who are basically vassals of Saudi Arabia, in power. How is that going to affect the revolts on the island of the 80% Shia that are, by the way, also they are a majority and only population. They're a minority in everything else in that artificial entity, that family company, but masquerading as a country. So what's going to happen? I don't know. But it makes Saudi's life a hell of a lot harder to try to keep the right people on the throne in Bahrain. We're going to see and sooner than later. And now that Saudi Arabia and Yemen seem to be going at it, Yemen, we saw the failure, the early failures of the PAC-3s back when the Saudis and the Yemenis were going, or the Houthis in this case, were going back and forth at each other to begin with. We saw that the PAC-3s were you know, every you would have what I call now Raytheon roulette, where every sixth to eighth missile just chooses its own path, where it's going to go, find some building to fall in love with and wax it. And you've seen that in Ukraine too, where, you know, one prime example was the Americans have put all the interceptors and the control base and the radar really close together, and one Kinjal missile basically took everything out. But as it was flying in, you see this Kinjal flying down, there were 36 missiles that were fired off on it. I mean, the people that were in the controls were desperate, just shooting everything off of it. Of course, it flew right through everything. But out of those 36 missiles, you can count about six missiles just going out absolutely different directions. Yeah, everything's going this way, and there's one that goes this way, one goes that way, another one goes that way. It's like, where are they going? Yeah, who knows? And I've seen videos like that from Saudi Arabia, where a guy standing in his balcony, there's a building perpendicular to him. There's a building perpendicular to him. The Saudi Patriot system shooting. And they're shooting at Tochka U's, old Soviet ballistic missiles. They're not exactly very fast. They're fast, but not too fast. So they should be an okay target for PAC-3 interceptors. And they're shooting one, they're shooting two, and a third one is flying out, decides to take a 90-degree turn, and smacks the building that this guy is standing on the balcony of, like two floors below him. And that's one of those first evidences that start coming out, how bad these systems actually work. And Professor Postel just showed that there, I mean, if you're hitting 6% intercept rate, that's pathetic. That's 94 missiles out of 100 that are just going somewhere. And that's a lot of money, and just continuing to build them is pretty pointless. But the U.S. government will continue to buy them. Raytheon will continue making money because this is all about corruption.
Yeah. Stas, thank you so much for being with us today. I know that it's too late there in Russia and you're traveling. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
It's always a pleasure. And I'll tell you this, just to understand Russians. So laying on the beach, I'm not going to say which beach. We're laying on the beach, the sirens kick in because there's a Ukrainian drones coming in. Nobody moves. Keeps laying on the beach. You can hear the drones fly over. Air battle starts somewhere down a ways. They're getting shot down. Sirens are wailing. Everybody's still laying on the beach. Like, whatever. This is Russians. Sherman Sheikh, I think that's the name. I'm butchering the name. In Egypt, it was a prime example when the Islamic jihadists of the Muslim Brotherhood overthrew the Egyptian government.
Sharm el-Sheikh.
All the Europeans and American tourists ran away in every direction because there's a little bit of a civil war that was going on. And the Russians just stayed in place. Keep shooting outside their resort. Don't come in here, or that becomes our problem. And then, you know, most of the Russian guys know how to use an AK. And you know what? The jihadists didn't come in there. There wasn't a single incident of them coming in screwing with the Russians. The Russians just finished their vacation and they let them all fly out. It's just easier that way. You start screwing with the Russians, they start shooting back. That's the Russian mentality. I mean, right there. So. And the Americans think they can, or the Europeans think they can freak Russians out and scare them. Yeah, I'm sure some small percentage will be susceptible. The vast majority are like, yeah, whatever. Seen worse. Our ancestors have seen worse. That's a bug flying in on the light. So that's the mentality, just to understand. That's what Russians are. We're not smart enough to know to run away. We just stick around and fight no matter what. You know, I'll just finish with Napoleon. Said that it's not enough to shoot a Russian soldier; you have to shoot him twice, and then you have to go up on the hill and knock him over. That's just it.
Yeah,
the problem in Ukraine is we're fighting ourselves. Those are Russians, even if they're mentally deranged. They're still Russians. That's why this fight is so hard, because we're fighting ourselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Stas. And see you soon. Have a great time, dude. Yeah.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. So